Let's start off with our topic at hand today. And I think, you know, we just finished up a session on the Haggadah last session. The question of how we relate to God and what the metaphors that we use for God, how those play out, is very central and relevant in so many ways to the story of Pesach itself. And we think this is not a session about, but you could have a whole session about, what does it mean in the Song of the Sea when the children of Israel sing to God and they say, Adonai Ish Milchama, God is a man of war. You know, what are we trying to get at there in that image? But one of the most prevalent images that we use for God outside of the redemption story itself is God as king. And what I want to do is spend this time thinking about what could it mean for God to be a king and how might we relate to that metaphor? What are the ways in which that can be unpacked? So when I say that, when I say God is king, what comes to mind? What are some of the, just sort of the immediate associations with king, either God as king or king generally? What comes to mind, sir?
Power.
Power. Okay, great. A king has power, and that's one of the fundamental defining aspects of king. What else, sir?
Well, in ancient times, well, even up to the 1800s in Europe, the divine right of king theory. The king, because he was king, had wisdom and knowledge that the average person wouldn't have. Therefore, whatever he's, you know, you should seek his guidance.
Great. The king is distinct from other humans. That's what makes the king the king. And, you know, getting back to the story of Passover again for a second, this was a war of the gods, where Paro was a god. Paro had divine authority, and that's how he had the ability to be king, in that sort of societal conception. So there is something about divinity that's invested in kings. How we were sort of boomerang that back to be, well, okay, well, what about God as king? God obviously has divinity. How can we connect to that? Or what's left over from being a king once you've sort of made it entirely about the divine? We'll see. Other thoughts about when I say king, what comes to mind? Yeah.
Male.
Okay, great. King, not queen, right? It is simply a fact that that, you know, when you picture that picture of the king, you can try really hard. We tried with our kids. We tried really hard never to say anything about the old white man in the chair in the sky, but it's like it's in the air, you know, they think of it. And it's like, okay, you can try hard to have God not be a gendered image, but king certainly is a gendered image. It's meant to be a gendered image as opposed to queen. And when you map that onto God, then I don't know if you have problems with that or not problems with it, but ultimately...
In particular.
Okay, but you're adding on that level of association where there's going to be a gendered aspect when you're talking about relating to God. But please.
Well, it's the pinnacle of power of the past. We've overthrown our kings. So that's not the source of awe and wonder in our lives.
Great. I think for Americans, this is a very difficult image, mm-hmm. right? I'd love to teach this class to a room full of Brits, you know, like right after the royal baby was born. But, you know, but we have this connection. King is, that was a political construct in the past that we evolved away from. We rebelled and beat. And the king is, you know, associated with the Tories. And it's like a lot of negative imagery there. Yeah, capricious, right, yeah. Say a word more.
It doesn't feel like authentic. It doesn't feel genuine and merit-based rule. It's some family of no connection to, got lucky at some point in time. It's nothing real to it.
Great, so you can see why the Hasbara group for the king has to come up with the divine authority. But it's, you know, you got lucky, what do you know? You were married into this cousin, whatever, right? You're the king, and that's capricious, and from hearing... So it's capricious in that you ended up in the position.
And
the king
and the ruler, right. the way they ruled.
Right, that's what I thought I heard you say, that the rule, the perhaps it's an expression of some deep insecurity, right? As a result of being capriciously assigned to the role, also the rulings that they make themselves are not necessarily fair, just, rational, you know, can be off with your head depending on how I experienced my breakfast this morning or something like that. Yeah.
Judgment is another image. King executes judgment or pronounces judgment.
Great. A king pronounces judgment, right? That's part of the role. You think of sort of King Solomon and the stories there and how you're going to actually try to execute something that's fair judgment. But ultimately, the king also holds that in no bifurcation of powers, the king is also the judge. Yeah.
The notion of monarchy, mono meaning one, meaning God.
Ah, great. Okay, there is one king. And in that way, you could maybe draw some similarity to it. That might be why you would draw upon this this adjective to describe God, or this metaphor to describe God, because you share the mono side of it, and as a result, nobody's going to dispute. They may not like the king, they may not like the king's rules, but ultimately, nobody's in dispute that there is one king, not two. Yeah, sir.
Is a hierarchical relationship, very much a hierarchical relationship, and it's really not even our place to argue or to try to. We can beg for mercy, but it's not where you can make your case, like in front of a judge.
Meaning in front of a civil court judge here in America, you say?
Right.
So the idea here is that you don't have, there is a hierarchy, I mean, there's a hierarchical relationship in a courtroom as well here, but the hierarchy is much more pronounced, right, when you're talking about a king who is, you can beg for mercy, but you're not going to be able to, I mean, maybe it depends on the king, you could have some reasoned argument, but fundamentally you are on the short end of the power stick in that relationship. Yeah.
In thinking of Vimnu Malkanu, the Russians refer to the Tsar as a father of, which implies concern.
Okay, great. There is this idea that the king actually is, in some benevolent way, related to his subjects in a way that is deep and emotional, and not necessarily as politically expedient. Again, different kings play on that out different ways, but there is this concept of, oh yes, there is some relationship that's going on here with the subjects, and maybe even though... I don't look for sources of strength. I guess to wrap that up with power, which I said earlier, power plus relationship, you have something that's actually going to, you know, to potentially work, at least in drawing someone, to experience the king in a positive way, or at least an effective way. I'm going to hand out the sheet. We're going to look at the way in which these metaphors get played out. I should say, I came across this quote from John Cheever from the Times a number of months ago. John Cheever, the American writer, he was describing a general bout that he was having with a bender. He was an alcoholic, and he was trying to sort of describe in written form what it means to try to get out of that spot when you are completely succumbed by your addiction. And he writes, on the top of page one, "I would like to pray, but to whom? Some god of the Sunday school classroom? Some provincial king whose prerogatives and rights remain unclear?" And here I'm hearing a little bit of what Mark was saying, you know, this idea of, and I think a lot of us have this idea of the Sunday school king, right? The Sunday school god, but also this provincial king, this local king, who is... capricious at worst, or unclear at best, right? It's not somebody who is laying out all the reasons for their rulings. I can't pray to a god like that, right, says John Cheever. And I think a lot of us often find ourselves in that spot of, what do you mean I'm going to pray to a king? That's something that is an image that's driving me away as opposed to drawing me in. And what I want to do in this session is really look at the way in which we are not the first group of people, not just Americans, not just 21st century people, we're not the first group of rabbinic Jews who have a problem with the metaphor of king and how they deal with it. Because I think the way they deal with it opens up a whole other apparatus of interpretation and ability to relate to a metaphor, at least experience the metaphor, that we might not have previously considered. So that's the goal here, is to open up the metaphor of king and understand it in a new way. Now, to start off, I want to sort of set the stage by a classic understanding of one of the paradoxes of a king. One of the paradoxes of a king is that you cannot be a king unless you have people to be king over. Right? You cannot be a king unless you have subjects. A king cannot rule an empty land. And we see that in a couple ways in the Midrash, in the legend literature from the rabbinic period. So if you just look on the bottom of page one, one of them is positive, one of them is negative, but both get to the same idea. This is the positive one. When God is creating the world, God consults with the Torah. There's no one really around pre-world, but the Torah is there, right? It's infinite. Immediately, God consulted with Torah, whose name is Wisdom, when considering whether to create the world. The Torah responds and said, "Master of all the world, if there's no army for a king, and no camp for a king, over what is he king? If there's no nation to praise the king, where is the honor of the king?" What's the argument that the Torah is making here that, yes, God, you should create humans even though they're going to be a real thorn in your side for eternity? What? Why do we need humans?
Can't be a king, otherwise.
Yeah, can't be a king, right? You cannot have glory. You cannot actually, there is no army for you unless you are able to have people to carry out your dominion. Yeah.
That is projecting onto divinity a very human emotion.
Yes, the emotion of?
Welcome to Rabbinic Judaism.
There's anthropomorphism and it's hype thing.
Uh-huh.
This is the same as Moshe arguing with God by embarrassment.
Uh-huh.
What will the Goyim think?
It seems to have some sway there.
It seems to me to be typical of biblical metaphorical usage for divinity.
Great. Okay, so we're going to see the way in which can you confuse God's emotions with human emotions, and what is the danger in doing that? What you're pointing out is in this text, oh God, you can't be a king, you can't have the glory of the king. Glory, I'm assuming, is something that humans want to chase after as opposed to God, and as a result, you need to be king, right? So that's one expression of this. Just to see it in another way, it's a little bit more in a post-human created world. We'll see how the force is a little bit different. On the top of page 2, Israel said before the Holy Blessed One, Master of the world, is there a king without a throne? Is there a king without a crown? Is there a king without a palace? And then they quote Psalm 13, how long will you forget me forever? Ad ana tishkacheni lanetzach. Ad ana tishkacheni netzach, meaning, how long will you forget me? Where are the Jewish people forgotten? When are the Jewish people feeling forgotten by God?
Of the exile.
Right. After the exile, right? This is a different conversation with God. The argument is the same, but in sort of the reverse courtroom scene, the Jewish people say to God, I know that you will not be able to forget me forever because you are a king and you need us. You need us to be your subjects. Now here also, this is in the post-destruction. You know, the first one was in the pre, everything hasn't happened yet. Should we create humans or not? This is after we've already been through the relationship. The relationship is broken, and Israel is coming back to God and saying, God, I know you're going to come back at someday because we have this relationship where you are king and I am the subject. And you can't be the king unless I'm the subject. Now, one of the differences is time, but another difference is who is the subject of the king in the first text versus in this text? Who becomes the subject? Who makes the king when the Torah is arguing in the first text? Humans, right? Humanity. God is king over all of humanity. In the second text, this is all about the Jewish people, right? Because God could say back, if it was not humanity, God could say back, thank you very much. I have plenty of subjects. They're over here, in the Sinai, whatever, in Africa, whatever it is, right? But here, the idea is that the Jewish people say, no, we have a special relationship with you as your subjects. We are the people who make you king, even though we're not all of humanity. So that itself is already getting to shows a flaw in the metaphor, which is if all God needs is humans, then God doesn't really need Jews, and therefore the Jews can't say to God, "I know you're coming back. You'll come back eventually. You need subjects."
No, He needs people who will recognize Him as king.
Ah, great. Okay, good. That's what God ultimately wants, is people who recognize Him as king. Maybe that's humanity. Maybe that's Jews. Jews have a pretty poor track record on that front, at least according to the Bible. But nevertheless. Maybe they're arguing here. Now, this is just simply to state that there is some relationship. In the metaphor, there is some relationship between the king and the people the king rules over. And that was recognized already by rabbinic sources. But what I want to explore as we go forward is, what is the idea in which God is a king for Jews? And how do we view that in a way that might be different than the way we assume that kings behave? And in order to do that, I wanted to draw a metaphor that you mentioned earlier, which is this idea of Avinu Malkeinu. Avinu Malkeinu is a very interesting set of two words that are mashed up together. We know it from the High Holiday liturgy, perhaps, but it actually comes in a story in the Talmud. The first time it's mentioned is in a story where the Jewish people are experiencing a drought. And when the Jewish people experience a drought, there's a formula that's supposed to happen. When you have a drought, you take the regular Amida, the regular standing silent prayer that normally has 18 blessings, and you add 6 more blessings to it in this very severe drought. You've done your fasting, you've done your this, you've done your that. This is already an emergency level dealing with drought. Okay? And when you add the six extra blessings, the rain is meant to come. That's what the law prescribes. But now we see a story in which the law doesn't always come out the way it says it's going to. We may have experienced this in our own lives. Okay, so I'm on page 2, story number 4. A story. Rabbi Eliezer led the Amidah and said 24 blessings, that is say 18 plus the additional 6 that's prescribed for a drought. Vilonana, he was not answered. It didn't work. What happened? Rabbi Akiva descended and said, Avinu Malkeinu, Ein Lanu Melech Ela'ata. Avinu Malkeinu L'mancha Rachem Aleinu. Our Father, our King, we have no King but you. Our Father, our King, for your sake, have mercy on us. V'yarduk Shamim. And the rain fell. Now what's the difference between what Rabbi Eliezer did and what Rabbi Akiva did? Rabbi Akiva did something and it worked. Rabbi Eliezer did something and it didn't work. How would you note the difference?
What Rabbi Akiva did is he acknowledged God as king. And the blessings don't necessarily do that. They're just asking, you know, thanking God for doing this or blessing God for doing that. But they're not necessarily a simple acknowledgement.
Yeah, I would say this is fascinating. There's a rule in the Talmud that says if you don't have the word king in a blessing, it's not a blessing. And yet, there is a major exception to that rule. The exception is the Amidah. The Amidah, which has 18 blessings, in this version it had 24 blessings, never says the phrase, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, God, King of the universe. So there's no acknowledgement in the Amidah of God as King. Now, you could say, well, there is, the word King shows up here and there, like Melech Ozer Moshe Omagein, but actually in some versions of the Amidah, that's missing. But at the end of the day, the blessing itself has no acknowledgement of King. So what Michael's pointing out is maybe just the step of acknowledging God as King is one of the things that Rabbi Akiva does that's different. Yeah, what else?
The other thing is the Amidah is sort of the classic prayer of pray for help, pray for things for me. And Akiva flips around and says, for your sake, not for our sake.
Ah, okay, good. For your sake, not for our sake, should you act. Now, the other thing which is fascinating is Rabbi Akiva doesn't simply say king. What does he say?
God.
Our Father, our King. Avinu Malkeinu. Now, if you're going to contrast the metaphor of parent and king, you could come up with some significant differences, I assume. Right? One of the things that Akiva does that's powerful is he mashes those metaphors together. By calling the king a parent, this is a little bit what you're getting at, is this idea of I have a relationship with my subjects. By calling the king a parent, by calling the parent a king, there is some added value to the metaphor, perhaps. We don't know why it works for Rabbi Akiva. But yeah.
What's interpretation of for your sake? What are the consequences if not? In other words, for your sake, have mercy on us. If you don't do it, then...
Right, if you don't do it, then not that you'll be punished, but that,
right.
You know, the Moses argument of that, it's the nations will not think that you're that powerful, right? You said that if you do these, you know, you said we could make it rain. Now we did all we're supposed to do. It's not raining. You know, you're a joke, right? You're going to be a mockery among the nations. Maybe that's part of what's getting at here. There is this idea of, you know, it's the we and you. We say we don't have any king but you. And you also have an interest in this. That is to say, I'm assigning some relationship. Imagine this is like Avinu Malkeinu. It's a little bit of like a teenager argument. You know, that is to say, that there's something where I'm going to remind you about your responsibility to me. Like, what do you mean I have responsibility? You're the one who has to be responsible, right? But ultimately, this is a two-way street. We have to say that we have no king but you, and you have to recognize that part of who you are is related to your relationship to us. Right? Now, Avinu Malkeinu as a mashup, I think, is pretty unusual, especially because you could also imagine, what makes you a father or a parent?
A child.
A child. Can you ever not be, once the child is there, are you ever not a parent? Right? It is an unbroken bond. It is an unbroken bond that you have with your, for better and for worse, you have that relationship with your child. And it can always be called upon. The problem is, and that's a good metaphor, you want that metaphor, but the problem is that sometimes the parent isn't as powerful as the king. Right? Your kid may, up to a certain point, think that you're super powerful, right? But in reality, you don't have that unlimited power that the king has. So when you put those two things together, that is to say, I have the relationship that's unbroken with the child, and I also bring in the power that I have with the king, now you're talking about something that's very potent. Okay? That, and maybe also that's something that Rabbi Akiva is drawing upon here. He's the first to put those metaphors together. You could imagine there are many prayers in which it's simply praying to a king, simply praying to a father, but here he's putting it together really for the first time. Okay, now what I want to do in the last section here is to look at the way in which we've established there are different ways of relating to God as a king, but I want to understand internally, I call God king, God has a relationship with us because God needs us in some ways to be king, but what does it mean for God to be king, and how is that different from the way that we think about a king? And in order to do this, I want to say very clearly here, if you're spacing out, I'll invite you to just focus for this sentence, then go back to spacing out, which is the way that the rabbis viewed God as king is the opposite of the way that people think of human king. God as king is the opposite of a human king. Whatever your image you have for a human king, the opposite is for God as king. And we're going to see how that plays out. It gets to this idea of God is fundamentally beyond metaphors. So any metaphor I take is going to be faulty. Because at the end of the day, God's going to transcend that metaphor. And what they do here specifically is instead of just transcending it, it's opposite. Okay? Whatever the king is, the human king is, God is the opposite of that human king. Now we're going to see this play out in two ways. One way is to say it's a matter of degrees. The king is X powerful, but God is 100 times X powerful. Right? That's one way of saying God is not like a human king. And then we're going to see some other more radical ones in which God is just simply the opposite of what it means to be a king. So let's see how some of this plays out. On number 6 on page 3. I've brought together a collection of sort of compare and contrasts. This is the first compare and contrast. A flesh and blood king, he has a patron who rules over one area but not another. Right? That is to say, he only has power over certain geographical areas. Even the supreme ruler, the cosmocrator, you know the word cosmos in there, rules over the land, but he doesn't rule over the sea. But God rules the sea and the land. God saves those in the water from the seas and those on the land from the fires. God is the one who saved Moshe from the sword of Pharaoh and saved Jonah from the belly of the fish in the water. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah from the fiery furnace, and Daniel from the lion's den. Thus it is written, Oseh shamayim va'aretz et hayam ve'et kol asher ba'am, makes heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in it. Right? So this text is, and you might expect this text, this is a good God PR text, right? Where you have a king, okay, you're the king, but what was a king at the end of the day? A king was a guy who ruled over this particular tract of land. If he were to cross the border, he is nobody anymore, right? And even if he was to rule like the Holy Roman Empire, he wasn't actually able to rule in the sea. But God controls everything. And the sea, I should say, is not just like a geographical area that is ungovernable. It is actually a stand-in for chaos. If you think of the sea and the way it plays out in the Bible, the sea and the sea monster is the instantiation of things that can't be controlled. And at the end, when you think of the creation story, when God separates the earth from the waters, that is controlling the sea. God is the only power that's stronger than chaos. God defeats chaos in creating the world. By putting order into the world, God defeats chaos. And that's part of what's playing out here. You can have a lovely king who can rule all over the land, but there'll never be chaos. And God beats chaos here. Yeah.
I know I may have missed it in your handout, but, you know, some of the examples are great, but still, you know, when I think of praying as God, you think of the power as a king, but in essence, when I relate to God, maybe at times a human image when I was a kid, but more so as I get older, as a spiritual force. Could you address just that?
Great.
In your conversation?
Great. So we're going to see the way in which, if you're not satisfied by, it's like sort of, you know, well, my superhero is stronger than your superhero. Well, at the end of the day, we're all still talking about superheroes. And, you know, in what way could we see in which this metaphor could go beyond?
It's just that kings also, when you study them in history, have tremendous faults as human beings.
Right.
And God is not a human being.
Right.
on that level, that's what I mean by, you know.
Good. Okay, so let's do a couple more of these. We'll do one more of the degree one, and then we'll get more into the realm that you're speaking about. So the next one down, quoting this verse from Psalms, which says, Shomea tefillah, one who hears prayer, adecha kol basar yavo, all flesh shall come to you. Okay, they take that verse from Psalms, and they do another compare and contrast. A flesh and blood king can hear two or three people, but he can't hear from everybody. But God is not so. Rather, all pray, and God hears their prayer as one. A flesh and blood person, his ears are filled from hearing and his eyes are filled from seeing. There's a limit to what your senses can experience. But God's eyes are not filled and ears are not filled. This is what it means, Shomea tefillah, adecha kol basar yavo. Everybody comes to pray to God at once. It's sort of, what was that movie with Jim Carrey and he was playing God? I forget what it was called. But there was a scene where he had to answer, he was answering everybody's email. Like they were praying to him, and he would respond by email. You see him like typing like this, you know, he could actually respond to all the emails. He can do it, but then he like takes a break, he's going to lie down. But, you know, but the ultimate story here is that God hears all prayer. You can imagine it would be very difficult if even three of us were talking at once. You can't pick out the distinguishing words. But if, and imagine like just even in a minion of 10 people, how could God distinguish that? God is different from humans. God can hear everything better. God can actually relate to everybody all at once, which is not a human trait. Humans cannot do that. God can do that, right? And in some ways, that's just a degree of the ability to hear, okay? But now let's go a little bit further and see the way in which God and kings are not degree separated, but just simply opposites. Okay, let's take a look. Someone want to read on page 4, number 8, A King of Flesh and Blood. Yeah, Michael.
A king of flesh and blood. If a person has a burn on him, or if a poor person asks after his welfare, it is a degradation to him, and he does not respond. But God is not so. All are accepted by him, and he says, praise me, it is good before me. As it says, it is good to sing to our God.
Okay, what's the distinction here between a flesh and blood king and God as king?
There are certain things that are below what a king shouldn't have to worry himself about.
Exactly. The dignity of the king is in some ways determined by the people who are in conversation with the king. And look at the categories here. If it's someone who has a physical deformity, a burn on him, or a poor person, that is say a socioeconomic deformity, right, or disadvantage, then that person simply doesn't approach the king. They don't have an audience with the king. Right? And probably that has to do with the way in which the king has to present himself. But if the king was talking to the burned people and the poor people, that wouldn't be very honorific for the king. Right? The king would suffer in some ways, or his image would suffer. God is the opposite, right? God says, all are accepted by me. Right? Ki tov zamra Eloheinu. It's good for everybody to sing to God. There is no distinction between the broken people and the whole people, between the rich and the poor. Yeah.
But halacha makes such distinctions.
Yeah.
A deformed kohen is not permitted to preside in the temple.
That's correct. Right. There are certain places in which the physical deformity is meant to play out a perfection where that would pull away from it. Interestingly enough, prayer is not the place where that happens. Meaning the temple was replaced by prayer. Right? And that's one of the democracy elements of prayer itself, is that even in a world where in the temple times there was a priestly caste that was having more access to God, but in this world, post-temple, there is a democracy element where everybody has access to prayer. Everybody has access to prayer, and God's going to listen to everybody. Yeah.
So is there some relationship then between this and, you were talking about the Amida before.
Yeah.
Amida, you said, we don't say king, we don't use God's name in that prayer, and yet it's open to everybody, and it's really asking for things for oneself.
Good, okay, so in the Amida you're asking for things for oneself, and yet you're not really calling God a king. So how does it relate to this? Yeah, what do you think? I mean, is this a different quality of prayer when I call God king? Or in some ways, is the Amida transcending the metaphor of king? Because at the end of the day, you could imagine a world in which people actually liked the metaphor of king. I mean, it had to work for somebody at some point. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it, right? They don't compare God to a giraffe, okay? So, you know, there is something where the metaphor was working at some point. But now you get to a stage where people are saying, no, we don't want to confuse you and let you think that God has anything to do with the real king. Maybe the Amida already did that by wiping out the word, right? And then you're having a different relationship with God. Maybe it's parent, maybe it's interlocutor, whatever it is. But if you're going to go down the king route, I got to tell you, it's not the king you thought of. It's not the king we overthrew from the Tories. It's not the king you learned about in fourth grade who was the bad guy. It is something totally different. It is a king who can actually do things that kings don't do, right? So let's see how that plays out a little bit further here. In number 10. And I put these in order of degrees, so we're going to get more and more radical as we go on. But yeah, go ahead.
It strikes me as you're talking that, yes, in the Amida, this concept of kings are so, but then you get to Rosh Hashanah.
Ah, then you get to Rosh Hashanah, and then what? It's king galore. All the time, right. King all the, yeah, so there's another, yeah, we'll have hopefully more opportunities to learn. We have a great class that we teach on Anunatana Tokef, and what is the image of God as a judge there? You mentioned the judging aspect of God being king. But certainly there are times during the year when, yes, we use the image of king, and now we want to understand at least how we could enter that metaphor, even if in ways that daily we don't necessarily do that. Okay, but let's see how this plays out a little bit more radically. Okay, number 10.
I'm actually hoping you're going to solve the daily problem more than anything.
Sorry?
I'm actually hoping you're going to solve the daily problem.
Okay, good. Which is a later prayer, but the idea that in the daily prayer itself, I mean, what Lisa's pointing out is that the central prayer doesn't actually talk about God as king, and even the Shema, you know, the word king only shows up in the Bible, in Torah, referring to God. This is a big problem for Rosh Hashanah. The word king only shows up in Torah 3 times, or all Torah referring to God. In the rest of the books of the Bible, it refers to God as called king, but in Torah itself only 3 times, and they run out of verses in Rosh Hashanah where they want to call God king because they have to take a certain number from Torah. So they kind of have to fudge it. And you know where they fudge it from? The Shema. The Shema, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad, is God as king. Only problem is the word king isn't in the Shema, right? So kind of they lost on the linguistic side, but the concept side they get, you know, it's like the rabbis say, when you say Shema, you're calling God king. All they forgot was to say the word king in Shema. But that's probably why in the Shema, how do we follow the Shema? What's the line? I say Shema and you say Baruch Shem Kibod Malchuto. Blessed is his glorious kingship. Right? That is, you know why you whisper Baruch Shem Kibod Malchuto? Partly because it's not in the Torah. it's inserted. They took 2 verses that were right next to each other. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Echad V'Ahavta Adonai Elohecha. Those are next to each other, and they pried them apart and stuck in this Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuto. You know what? People were like, maybe we should, since we just added a verse, maybe we should say it a little softly, because it's like a little bit chutzpahdik to do that, right? I mean, that's one possible explanation, the other explanation of the Talmud about that. But the idea is that Melech sneaks into the Shema, but it has to sneak in, right? But if you just look at the core daily prayer that Jews do, the Shema and the Amida, king, as a metaphor, is really not central at all. It doesn't show up linguistically. You do say Mode Ani, but Mode Ani as a prayer is like from the 17th century.
The rabbi referred to Shema as accepting Ol Malchut.
Correct, Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim. That's what the rabbis understood the Shema already as this idea of I'm calling, and the rabbis were totally out there saying Baruch Shem Kavod Malchut. They were saying no. But the point is that you can certainly go through your daily Jewish prayer life without having to deal with the king metaphor so much. You, of course, have to deal with it every time you make a bracha. I'm like,
very hungry.
Right.
Exactly, right. When you have to eat something, you're saying the word melech. Okay, so let's get back to the melech stuff here and see if we can unpack a little bit more about it. On the bottom of page 4, number 10, Binoach Sheva Olam, it's the way of the world that a flesh and blood king makes a decree. If his underlings want to cancel it, they can't. Rather, this is the idea of, all the authority of governance is in the king. Rather, willingly or unwillingly, they uphold the decrees of the king. But the king, if he wants to uphold it, it's upheld. And if he wants to cancel it, it's canceled, right? The king has total and complete control over the law. That's the flesh and blood king. But God is not so. This is, I think, pretty interesting. Whatever his Sanhedrin below declares, God upholds. Whatever the court, the human court below declares, God takes the law from the lower court. Turn over the page. When? Here comes the Rosh Hashanah part. On Rosh Hashanah. When the Sanhedrin, when the court sits and says, We declare Rosh Hashanah to be on Monday or on Tuesday. Immediately, what happens? God convenes the upper court, the upper Sanhedrin of ministering angels, and says to them, go down and see what the lower court agreed to and decreed. They respond, Master of the Universe, they concluded that Rosh Hashanah should be on such and such a day. Immediately, God sits and judges his world. As it says, God rose with the blast, Adonai with the voice of the shofar. The chairs are set, the books are open, the Sanhedrin sits with him. As it says, I beheld till thrones were placed, and one that was Ancient of Days did sit. What's the legislative process here in God's lawmaking situation?
When it comes to setting the calendar, the Sanhedrin below governs.
Good.
But if the Sanhedrin below were to announce that from now on pigs are kosher,
okay, good. You're right to say that the example that's taken in this Midrash is the one in which Jews and humans have control. How do you know what day Rosh Hashanah is? Rosh Hashanah is you look in your calendar that was sent by the shul. But before they were mailing out those calendars and they told you what date it was, they had to check with the moon, right? And they had to declare. And the way they would do that was through human witnesses giving testimony in a court. That's when they would figure out if Rosh Hashanah was on a Monday or on a Tuesday or whatever it was, right? And what this Midrash says is God accepts that declaration. There are three levels of judgment here. There's the bottom level, the humans. There's the upper Sanhedrin, which is the angels. And then there's God, right? How does it work? God says to the higher court, go check out what the lower court says. They check out what the lower court, what's the higher court? They're just a messenger service, right? Literally a malach. They're a messenger. They're an angel. They go from the lower court. They bring it back up to God. God says, oh, Rosh Hashanah this year is late. It's on Tuesday. You know, it's in October, okay? And that's what God decides. But what's interesting is this Midrash doesn't say, and on Rosh Hashanah, people have control over the law. They say, generally, see how the law is different in a human court, in a human king rulership situation versus God. They take the example of Rosh Hashanah, maybe the only example where the human court actually gets to run the show, but that's what they expand out big to be. This is what God listens to humans when declaring the law. Yeah.
Is all about it, I mean.
Right. The way in which humans play out a role in declaring the law has something to do, there's some part of that that's encoded in Jewish law. But what the point here is that this Midrash itself sees, this legend sees the legislative process opposite from the king. The king makes the laws. That's what I know about a king. He's capricious with his laws. He's not capricious. He's merciful. Whatever it is, he makes the king. You want to undo the law? You can't. Only he can do it. But God is the opposite. God doesn't make the law. Yeah.
As you're talking about this, it's not just here. There's a whole Elu.
Right, exactly.
Right. Yeah, right, exactly. There's this idea that God, you know, my sons have defeated me in that story, right. Is the idea that God isn't in charge of the legislative process, ultimately.
Well, read the next paragraph.
Right, okay, we're not going to get into Tanur Shalach Nai. It's a very complicated and also depressing, tragic story. It's not easy when humans have control over the law. There are some serious consequences. But in this version, what we see is that God, unlike a human king, the opposite of a human king, the subjects or the lower court is actually running the legislative process here. Something that would never be thought of in a human court. Okay, let's look for a little bit more. Let's do the next one, number 11. Another interpretation, Lamanatzeach, for the leader. For the one who is defeated, Minutzach, by his creator. This is Nitzchuni Banai. My sons have defeated me. A flesh and blood king, if you defeat him, he's angry, right? Kings don't like to be beaten, right? But God is not so. Defeat him, and he is happy, as it says. Therefore, he said that he would destroy them, had not Moshe, his chosen, stood before him in the breach. That is to say, when God wanted to destroy the Jewish people after the golden calf, only Moses prevented that destruction from happening. God's will was defeated, and God was happy, right? There's this idea of God wants to be defeated. I want the human to stand and argue for mercy, even though I want to put forth retribution and punishment. Right? There is this aspect to God that God wants to be defeated. And that's not something that kings who are human ever have a connection to. Human kings don't like to lose. God king does like to lose. Again, in a specific example. Okay, let's take a couple more. I will see your face in righteousness. This, I think, is very powerful. Ani betzedek achazeh panecha, on the bottom of page 5. I will see your face in righteousness, or betzedek. What do you hear the word tzedek? What other Hebrew word comes from that?
Tzedakah,
right? Justice and tzedakah, charity, are related in the same root. Rabbi Dostai Bar Yonah said, Come see how God is not like flesh and blood. Turn the page. Flesh and blood. If you bring a gift to the king, it's in doubt whether he will receive it or not. And even if he receives it, it's in doubt whether you will see the face of the king or not. And even if you see the face of the king, it's in doubt whether or not he will do your will. Let's say this year I was invited to the White House Hanukkah party, which was the closest I've ever been to standing before like a king figure. And the kid, so there's like a rope line, and the kid who was standing next to me, he was the only kid in the room, he was 10 years old, he was the inventor of the menorche. You know what the menorche is?
The
turkey-shaped menorah, okay? So you can see him. He's, you know, you're waiting for like hours and hours for, you know, for Obama to show up. And he's in the meantime having this negotiation with a Secret Service agent where he's basically saying, will you please take this menorche and give it to President Obama, right? And so finally the Secret Service agent takes the menorche and brings it like behind the door. And then you sort of think to yourself, is that Secret Service agent really going to give the menorche to President Obama? You know, this is the when you give a gift to the king, is the king really going to get the? Is the king going to see you? Is he going to get the gift? By the way, what happened was, so Obama comes out. He singled out two people in his speech. He's a very good Jewish speechwriter. One was the person who came up with the term Thanksgivica. If you invented Thanksgivica, you got invited to the White House. And the second one was this kid. And he said, you know, we have with us, you know, so-and-so from Somerville, Pennsylvania, you know, and he invented the menorche. And then he turns around and he said, Michelle, where's the menorche, you know? And then you see the Secret Service guy, like, scurrying to the back, grabs the menorche, brings it out to Obama, and, you know, Obama's holding up the menorche to kids, right? So but the idea is, it's exactly as it's played out in this text, which is, like, you give a gift to the king, you don't even know if the gift is going to get to the king, you don't know if the king's going to recognize it, and at the end of the day, why are you giving a gift to the king in the first place? Because you want the king to do your will, right? There's some sort of bartering system here. You're buying off the king, okay? That's the way in which you give a gift to the king. Yeah, exactly. But with God, it's not so. Okay, back in the text, but with God, it's not so. And this is amazing, I think. It's really incredible. A person gives a coin to the poor, he merits to see the face of the Shekhinah. As it says, I will see your face in righteousness. Ani betzedek achazeh panecha. I shall be satisfied when I wake with your likeness. Ani betzedek achazeh panecha. Ani betzdaka achazeh panecha. I will behold your face when I give charity. When I give charity, I merit to see the Shekhinah. That is to say, first of all, what's the gift in this scenario?
Access to God.
Yeah, that's the reward. No, but that's what I want. I want to have access to the Shekhinah, but I give the gift not to God, not to the king, but I give it to the poor person. The poor person is the agent, as it were, but it is a direct line to God. And when I give the tzedakah, when I give that charity to the poor, I merit to see the face of God. There's no doubt that when I give tzedakah, when I give that gift, the real gift, right, not the token gift, the real gift, then I'm actually experiencing the presence of God. So there is, with a flesh and blood king, you never know if your gift is going to achieve its purpose. But with the gift that you want, what could you give to God the king? There's no gift you can give to God, right? This, you know, the sacrifice is a joke in this metaphor. But the only gift you can give is to support the poor with charity. That's the gift that God wants, and when you do that, you see the face of God. Okay? Now, the very last one, I think, I love this text, because it gets to the idea in which all the trappings of what it means to be a king are, in fact, very important for human kings, completely irrelevant to God. Okay? And we're going to see a series of them in this last text. So this is on the bottom of page 6, middle of page 6. Who is the king of glory? Mi hu zeh melech ha-kavod. Who is the king of kavod, of glory? The one who gives his glory to those who fear him. Adonai Tzevaot. God, the Lord of hosts, is this king, the king of glory. What makes God so glorious? God is able to distribute the glory to all the other people who are his subjects. Now, how does this work? A flesh and blood king, one cannot sit on his throne. But God sat King Solomon on his throne, as it says, Solomon sat on the throne of God. Pretty good proof text, by the way. Right? God is able to share God's throne. A flesh and blood king, one cannot ride his chariot. But God caused Elijah to ride his horse, since storms and whirlwinds are his horse, as it says, Adonai in the whirlwind and in the storm was his way, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. And it says Elijah rose in the storm, right? When Elijah goes up to heaven and doesn't actually die, he rides a storm, but that's seen as God's chariot, right? And God is able to share his chariot with people, not so with a flesh and blood king. So we've got a throne, we've got a chariot, one more. A flesh and blood king says one cannot use his scepter. You can't walk into the king's throne room and start grabbing the scepter and waving it around. But Moshe used the scepter of God, as it said. Moshe took the staff of God in his hand. Mate Elohim biyado. He took the staff of God. A flesh and blood king, one doesn't wear his crown. Could you imagine wearing the crown of the king? But God gives his crown to the anointed king Messiah. God's crown is gold, as it says, his head is the most fine gold, or Shel Ketem Paz. And it's written, you set a crown of fine gold on his head, right? That this crown of fine gold actually ends up on a human head. So we've got the chariot. We've got, what else do we have? We've got the chariot, we've got the scepter, we've got the throne, we've got the crown. A flesh and blood king, you don't wear his clothing. But Israel wore the clothing of God, as it said, Adonai oz le'amo yitein. God gave strength. In other Psalms, the oz v'hadar lavashta, is that you wore strength. Strength is God's clothing, and God gave strength to Israel. A flesh and blood, this is the kicker, a flesh and blood king is not called by his name. You don't walk up to King Henry VIII and say, Henry, how's it going, right? Or his real given name.
Neither is God.
What?
Neither is God.
Neither is God what?
Called by his name.
Oh, good. Okay, well, hold on. Let's read it here a little bit. God's name is a complicated issue. A flesh and blood king is not called by his name, like Caesar Augustus Basilius. If a person calls one of those names, he has no life. You walk up to Caesar and say, hi, Caesar, he chops off your head, right? But God said to Moshe, I made you like a pharaoh. I am called God, and I created the world. I am called Elohim, as it says, Bereshit bara Elohim. And you are called God, essentially, and it is written, behold, I have made you, nitaticha, Elohim, I have made you, not like a God, really, I have made you God to Pharaoh. Right? So at the end of the day, even God's name, God is willing to share with his subjects. All these things that make up what a king is, we said before, what is the difference between a human regular Joe and a human king? Not a whole lot DNA-wise, nothing, really. It's just the trappings. It's the crown, it's the throne, it's the chariot, it's the title, right? It's the clothes, all that stuff. You dress them all up, they become a king. And that's what a human king is. It's a dressed up person. But God doesn't actually care about any of that stuff. In fact, God shares it all. You can sit on my throne, you can use my scepter, you can even be called God. You can be called the name God. It's pretty unbelievable. And I'm not worried about it because I don't have any insecurities around the issue of the title of king because I am not like a human king. Right, so at the end of the day, yeah.
It ties into humans being made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, say a little bit more.
Well, so it's saying all my attributes, my character, the reason why I put you in this world is so that you can embody that and interpret that in chesed and tzedek and, everything else that comes with it.
Great, right. The idea that God and humans are actually linked through the image is very different. The king does everything, the human king does everything he can to change his image. He looks different from everybody else. That's how he gets his power. God gets power by actually being similar in that way, right? And that's a very, very strong message. So at the end of the day, I think what the rabbis and the author of these texts here are trying to say is that, yeah, we have a problem with the metaphor of king also, because you might go down the path of thinking that when we call God king, we're talking about all the attributes that you associate with the human king that we were able to generate in the beginning. But what they're saying here is, at the end of the day, whatever you think about a king, a human king is, God's the opposite. God is not that human king. God is something totally different. And yes, I have to use metaphors to get at God in the first place at all. But if I'm going to use a metaphor, I'm going to tell you the metaphor is the opposite of the way that you experience the metaphor itself. In some ways, it's like a mind-bending metaphor. I know something about what a human king is, and I can derive the opposite about God. And then, I don't know if that helps you relate to God, but at least it doesn't confuse you with thinking that when you pray to God as king, you're dressing up some human in a whole bunch of robes and chariots and crowns, and that's what you're praying to.
It's a solid, and that's why the words are melech chai v'kayam. it invites you to think about it. Imagine if it could be alive and really functioning in this magical sort of way.
Okay, great. Sort of live and
real.
Yeah, real. You know, not a metaphor.
This idea of, you know, giving tzedakah is a way to get access to it. Sharing this idea of, no, it's not a king on a throne. It's a melech chai v'kayam, what you do and what you wave.
Great. I love that. That melech chai v'kayam, yeah, brings it home. Yeah, please.
But there's still ego there.
Yeah. In the
God.
Yeah, it's interesting. Even in the
and
last, do you see it in the last source? Because I see the ego there in certain places where it's like, for God's sake, you know, Avinu Malkeinu L'mancha, for your sake, you have mercy on us. In the last verse, I sort of see like God saying, take everything. Take, you know, my name, my throne, all my trappings. And, you know, now, whether, you know, God is a complex character. And indeed, in interpretation also, God has been described in different ways. But what I want to leave us with here today is, when you think of God as a king, it's not the king that you learned about as a kid. It's something opposite. And if that can help make some progression into what it would mean to stand before that king in prayer, hopefully we'll have made a little bit of progress in getting closer to God.